Dr. David Grinspoon is a astronomer.
He's a planetary astronomer, isn't that correct?
Yeah, planetary scientist.
And besides being a writer of books that are being published by Addison Wesley, you hold a position with NASA, don't you?
Yeah, well, I work at the University of Colorado, but I do research that's funded by NASA. So they pay my bills.
You work with some of those space probes that send back information from different planets, right?
Yeah, I've been involved in analyzing data from a few different spacecraft missions.
Now, before we get into the meat of the matter, your book is called Venus Revealed, and it's all about the planet Venus, which is that real bright one that you see right after dusk or right before dawn.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, it's coming back in the evening now. Venus is just peeking out behind the sun in the evening, and all summer long and into the fall of 97, it's just going to get higher and higher and brighter and brighter, and you'll begin to notice it as this unavoidable presence in the evening for the rest of 97.
If you're working for NASA, Dr. David Grinspoon, are you in on the great conspiracy? Do you believe that spaceship that went to Mars really exploded and got lost?
Well,
or is it really sending back data?
I'm not really supposed to talk about that.
That's what I thought.
But, they pay my bills, so I have to adhere to the party line. It just blew up.
It really,
in all seriousness, that one was just an unfortunate, some kind of mechanical error. The thing about all these NASA conspiracies, I mean, I worked at a NASA research lab for a long time, and that's still funded by NASA. The problem with all these conspiracies is that, you know, there's way too much ineptitude to actually maintain a conspiracy like that. And, you know, somebody would spill the beans.
You're not the first person with NASA who has told us that on the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show.
Is that true?
Your book is about the planet Venus. Tell us a little bit about the planet Venus. I mean, here's what Rob and I know. It's really bright. It's up in the sky. It's supposedly really hot and hellish and covered with clouds. But you think maybe there could be life there.
Yeah, well, the thing about life in the universe is we have to recognize how ignorant we are, and that we really can't rule it out anywhere, because we don't really know what life is. We don't know what we're looking for when we look for life.
Well, aren't you usually looking for water and carbon, which are the basic building blocks of life?
Yeah, that's the general tack that's usually taken, you know, because we have to start somewhere. So we say, well, what allows life to exist here on Earth, and then can we look for those conditions elsewhere? But the problem with that approach is that we end up looking for conditions that are just like the conditions here on Earth. And I, partly as a devil's advocate argument, but partly because I really believe it, advocate that Venus is an environment where we might find life, simply because we don't know that life has to be based on carbon and water like it is here on Earth.
So there could be some kind of evil acid eaters and stuff up there?
Yeah, you know, maybe really nice acid eaters, you know? I've met some nice acid eaters. But no, the thing is that there are other aspects of the Venusian environment that may be very conducive to life. Venus is a very active planet, we've recently learned with a spacecraft called Magellan, that Venus is still a geologically active planet. There's a lot going on there in the surface, and the atmosphere is constantly recycling and renewing itself, which is like the Earth, or unlike any other place.
So you're saying Mars and Jupiter and all these other planets out there, and even the Moon, don't renew themselves? What's the implication of that?
Yeah, Mars and the Moon are dead worlds, geologically speaking. Nothing really very much has happened on them for billions of years.
You're saying the rocks and the craters just sit there, there's no erosion, there's no tectonic plates moving around, it's just sitting there.
In general, one thing we've learned through comparative planetology, which is what I do for a living, which is looking at the different planets and trying to understand the similarities and differences, one thing we've learned is that the smaller a planet is, the longer ago it cooled off. A small planet cools off quickly. Mars and the Moon, because they're a lot smaller than the Earth, cooled off earlier in their history, and there's no heat driving any kind of geological activity. So they are just kind of sitting there. They're dead worlds. There's not that much going on.
Well, what's so alive about Venus, and what does Venus have in common with the Earth as far as its vibrancy?
Well, getting back to this thing about the size, like I said, Mars and the Moon cooled off quickly because earlier in the history because they're small and they're dead now. The interesting thing about Venus is it's exactly the same size as the Earth. Almost.
Exactly?
Almost. It's like I say in my book, if Earth was a regulation NBA basketball, then Venus is a soccer ball. It's slightly smaller, but it's the closest planet by far in size. And the interesting thing about that is the reason why Earth is still an active world, you know, we've got plate tectonics and volcanoes and stuff, is because there's a lot of heat left inside because it takes longer for a big planet to cool off. Earth still has its heat of formation and a lot of radioactive heat. And that's what's leading to all this activity that we're familiar with on the surface. Well, Venus is the same size and also has a lot of interior active heat. It's a living world. It's alive and kicking like the Earth. And with the recent images we've gotten of the surface from Magellan, we've learned that Venus has active volcanoes and has, well, not earthquakes, but Venus quakes. And also the atmosphere seems to be cycling and renewing itself, just like Earth. You know, on Earth, we've got this carbon cycle that we, in fact, ourselves are part of that helps Earth be a good place for life, right? Because there's this constant resupply of nutrients and so forth. Well, Venus, the interesting thing is, has chemical cycles. It doesn't necessarily have an active carbon cycle, but it has a sulfur cycle that is very active.
Sulfur is nasty stuff, isn't it?
Well, it's nasty to us. Well, it depends. I mean, we actually need sulfur to live. Some of our amino acids have sulfur in them. I mean, you think of sulfur and you think of sulfuric acid. And
you think of the devil.
Smelly, rotten eggs and the devil. Exactly. You think of hell. But the interesting thing is the connection with hell being associated with sulfur is probably originally because volcanic vents have sulfur gases coming out of them, right? And people used to think that that was a connection to the underworld. Well, Venus also has volcanic vents breathing out sulfur gases into the atmosphere, and that makes it a dynamic place. And in my opinion, when we look around the universe and think about where we need to look, what kind of conditions we should look for to look for places that could have life, I think we should look for active worlds like Earth and like Venus. And maybe we should look for water and carbon, but we should also admit that we don't know that life has to be made out of those chemicals.
Life could be made out of sulfur or something completely different.
Yeah, see, because we only have one example, right, of a biosphere. And in science, you can't really base firm conclusions on one example of anything. If you have one example, you have to keep an open mind until you find other examples. So, you know, there's sort of a party line about exobiology. Exobiology is the study of life elsewhere.
Now, before this gets too heavy,
sure.
Dr. David Grinspoon, this is the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. If you just tuned in, Dr. David Grinspoon wrote this book about the planet Venus. It's called Venus Revealed. It's available at your local bookstore. We're opening up the Secret Celebrity Hotline at 961-8900. If you'd like to talk to Dr. Grinspoon, and we have a caller. His name is Halls.
Yeah, hello, doctor.
Hi there.
Hi, thank you for having your exchange of ideas here.
And no problem.
It's really great. And I just wanted to remind you that just in regard to some of the more recent discoveries in physics, you would understand that the kind of life forms that would exist on Venus right now may not be perceivable from our viewpoint, our perception, in other words, in space and time. We know that it is our illusion of space and time that we experience as that particular quality, which makes us not be able to see what is actually going on Venus.
Halls, are you saying there may be ghosts on Venus?
Well, you might consider them ghosts from our viewpoint, but I'll give you some information that I got. It is supposedly from extraterrestrial sources.
I hope you got it from the internet. Please tell me you got this off the internet.
Dr. Grinspoon,
this may be one of your happy ass eaters
we were talking
please
about.
Please tell me this is off the internet.
I hear some sitar music in the background.
Well, I'd also like to just remind you.
It makes me wonder, but.
Well, this is part of this, I'm sure. But the Venus evolutionary solar system starts out quite similarly to that of Earth, particularly in regard to the spirit experiencing the more fundamental levels of existence. There is a major difference from Earth, though. This is because the vibrational frequency of Venus is so much higher than that of Earth.
You know,
souls have a very different experience
I'm afraid you're a little bit beyond my area of expertise here. I am not too personally experienced with kind of an astral projection and,
sure.
and crystal channeling and things of that nature. But what you're talking about sounds interesting.
Yes, it would be called Hesper. If you remember, it was called Hesper, and there's a book that was written in 1884.
Sure, Phosphor and Hesper were morning and evening star for the Greeks, which they actually thought that Venus was two different planets in the morning and the evening.
Those Greeks were morons.
Well, I don't know. They came up with some good stuff, you know, but they were products of their time and place, like all of us are.
They really liked their sex, those Greeks did. Okay, is everybody there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. We're having a little trouble with the phones.
This is the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. We're talking to Dr. Grinspoon. Can we start calling you David now?
Sure.
David, what kind of atmosphere is on Venus?
Stinky one, sounds like.
A very thick atmosphere, and it's almost all carbon dioxide, CO2. A
lot of cars on
and,
Venus?
No, but actually, you know, there are some really interesting I don't think there's any cars. We haven't seen any, although if there were, we wouldn't have seen them yet because our pictures aren't that good. But there's some interesting parallels between global warming on Earth and the greenhouse effect on Venus. You figure we're worried about the fact that we're putting a little bit of CO2 in our atmosphere from cars and factories, and it's heating up. Well, on Venus, the reason why it's so hot is because the atmosphere is almost all CO2. And it's the exact same thing. It's a greenhouse effect gone wild. And actually studying the atmosphere there is making us a little bit smarter about climate modeling here on Earth. And so there's a practical benefit there for us as far as our own survival here on this planet.
So, but if it's completely CO2 on Venus, well, you know, we'd really have to start pumping out the gremlin fumes to get that bad, wouldn't we?
Yeah, it's not like we're in danger of turning Earth into another Venus. It's more like Venus serves as an example that allows us to test our computer models of atmospheres and see how good they are, see if we really know as much as we think we know. It's another example of a planet that allows us to test our models and just get better at climate modeling. But it's really an extreme case of a greenhouse effect.
Do you think we should send people to Venus? When are we going to quit sending people around the Earth? We've done that. We need to send somebody to Venus.
Yeah, well,
we
sent
people to the moon.
I think it would be really cool. I mean, to go to the surface of Venus would be pretty tough. You'd have to design a really good suit because it's 900 degrees there. The surface pressure is almost 100 times what it is on Earth.
So how could we do that? That would be one hell of a spacesuit.
Yeah, it would be. But actually, there's another thing you can do, which is send people into the clouds of Venus.
Oh, you mean like they'd never land?
Well, you could land, but as far as a place where we would be comfortable, I think it would be kind of neat to go ballooning in the clouds, because there's a level in the clouds that is pretty much room temperature and pressure, and all you would need would be basically like a good rubber suit or something that would protect you from the acid clouds. The clouds are made out of sulfuric acid, so you'd want something to protect you from that, but it's not all that hot up there.
It would be kind of like that floating city in the sun that Billy Dee Williams was hanging out in that Star Wars movie.
Exactly,
then.
Yeah.
That's cool.
You could make a floating city in the clouds of Venus. And,
how expensive
would that be?
My vote.
How expensive would it be?
Yeah, trillions and trillions or what?
Yeah, you know, I've never even been concrete enough about the idea to actually calculate a price tag. It wouldn't be cheap.
And it's start a new tax.
It's not the kind of thing that you could, you know, think of an immediate practical benefit for, but just in the spirit of dreaming about the human future and exploration and what we might do, it's a fun thing to think about. But it's certainly, it would be an extravagant thing to start doing right now before we've solved some of our problems here on Earth.
Did you hear about that study, Dr. Grinspoon, that the Earth is getting colder?
Yeah, you know, I've heard some reports. I've heard a lot more studies that the Earth is getting warmer, but the interesting thing is that we're not totally sure because the Earth is a really, really complex system. There's no doubt that if we keep pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, it's going to get warmer. But the fact that there are these different studies that don't all agree at present is just another illustration of how hard it is to do climate modeling and how complicated the Earth is. See, because there's all these feedbacks. You change one thing and it changes 100 other things.
Speaking of feedback.
It's not like a simple thing to model. And that's why it's really valuable for us to study other planets, study Venus in particular, because It, you know, it's another reference point to see if we can really do climate modeling and predict the future of the Earth.
So does that burn your butt every time there's a cold day in July and you hear the Rush Limbaugh right-wing environment hatist come on the air and say, well, there goes your global warming theory. Ha, 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 look,
yeah.
It's 55 in July. Ha, 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 ha. Where's
exactly,
your global
yeah.
warming at now?
You know, I mean, it's kind of on a day-to-day basis, you know, no matter how smart we get, we're never going to be able to predict the weather. So that's not really the point. But
you have to look at like a 100-year period or something, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
A big, long period.
You need a long time base before you can separate out the short-term fluctuations from the real long-term trends.
We're going to take another call, if that's okay with you, Dr. Grinspoon.
Sure.
It's been
maybe we'll get some more feedback.
It's been an adventure. Let's talk to Charlie. Hi, Charlie. You're on with Dr. David Grinspoon.
Hello, doctor.
How you doing?
I went to University of Colorado.
Oh, all right.
From there. It's a wonderful school.
Go Buffs.
You guys got the same dealer?
But, no, it's wonderful. And there's a new show I heard on the radio. It's called E-Town.
Oh, yeah, out of Boulder.
Yeah, it comes out of Mackey Auditorium, I guess.
Yeah, actually, I'm supposed to be a guest on that show one of these days.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they play it on, I have to mention another station because they don't carry it on the side, but NKU or whatever carries it. I know Thursday it's something. I skip work.
Yeah, it's kind of music and environmental commentary.
Yeah, it's cool. I've been to Mackey because I saw Bobby McFerrin there and a few nuclear activists. Who is that woman? Helen Caldicott.
Oh, yeah, Helen Caldicott.
Yeah, and
She wrote Missile Envy.
Yeah. Well, you guys haven't brought up the big giant ice balls the size of houses.
Yeah, what about that, Doc?
Oh, yeah, you know.
And also, here's my theory. If they're hitting Earth, why isn't there water on every planet, then?
Well, you know, that's a very, very good point.
Oh, wait, slow down here, Dr. Grinspoon. David, I'm going to call you now. What are these? Let's go back to the very beginning. I saw this thing in the newspaper, but a lot of people don't know what we're talking about. What are these giant ice balls the size of houses?
Well, you know, it's a really strange thing because there was an observation made about 10 years ago. This guy, Dr. Louis Frank, thought he saw these things in the satellite images, and basically everybody, most people in the scientific community kind of said, you're nuts, they're not there, they can't be. But now they've seen them in this new satellite image, and it looks like they might be there. But there's a problem that I have with that, and it's exactly what the caller, was your name Tim?
Charlie.
What Charlie mentioned is a very astute comment, because he's exactly right. Supposedly these things are bringing in all this water into Earth, these small comets.
That's
right?
Why it's been raining constantly the last 4 weeks.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
good
right.
point. But the weird thing is, and this is the problem I have, and I was actually thinking of writing a scientific paper about this. Maybe Charlie's going to be my co-author here. But why isn't, if this stuff is coming into Earth, it ought to also be coming into Venus, and Venus is so dry that you could prove.
Yeah, but it's 900 degrees on Venus, so it evaporates immediately.
Ah, but you should have the water. The comets would still be adding water to the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere.
Well, are these coming things coming into Mars?
Well, that's another good question, because Mars, the atmosphere is pretty dry, too.
They got those ice caps.
So, yeah, but there's not much water there. So, but see, there's a couple ways around this, right? What if these things haven't been hitting all that long? Maybe it's a recent rain of these little comets. Maybe they're from a giant comet that broke up and it's just been hitting for the last few thousand years or something, and it hasn't had much time to build
up. Or maybe that's where all of our oceans came from.
Well,
that's the theory.
That's what they're saying, but that's the problem. If our oceans came from these things, then there ought to be an ocean's worth of water on Venus, and it's not there.
Yeah, why is there salt in the ocean, too?
Okay, and then one last comment to show that all your callers know maybe know something besides astro projecting into the space. Anyway, we don't even know what life is on this planet, because for a long time we're saying, well, you need light and oxygen for life. Well, suddenly we find life that doesn't need light. And then suddenly we find life that doesn't need oxygen, isn't there? Anaerobic?
No, you're right. There's a trend here. We keep finding life in more and more seemingly exotic locations. We keep finding that the limits of life are much broader than we thought, and that life can exist in all kinds of weird locations, underground in caves that never see the light of day, in these hot sulfur vents at the bottom of the ocean in Antarctica, everywhere on Earth, every possible weird environment, there's life. So that just demonstrates that maybe we don't know what the ultimate limits of life are. Now, it's true that all the life we know of is carbon-based and lives in water, which puts a temperature range on its existence. And that's what we usually say when we look for life on other worlds, that it has to be within the temperature range of liquid water. But even that, I personally think, is just an assumption that we're making based on our own experience, and we don't really even know that.
Hey, Charlie, thanks for your call. Dr. Grinspoon, I want to ask you, since we're talking about life in all these weird, exotic places, there's a theory out about this moon called Europa that's going around Jupiter, and it might have giant icebergs on it, and underneath the icebergs, there might be volcanoes and underground life creeping and crawling around these volcanoes. What can
like
you
the
tell
Doozers.
Us? Yeah, like the Doozers. Who are the Doozers?
From Fraggle Rock.
Okay. What can you tell us about them?
Yeah, well, again, you know, the connection here is water. Europa is a moon of Jupiter, and the surface is clearly made out of water ice. There's no doubt about that. We've determined that. And we think that underneath the ice, there may be an ocean of liquid water. And the recent pictures from the Galileo spacecraft suggest that there have been icebergs that have moved around, which makes it even more likely that there's liquid water under there. And again, the idea is that as far as we know, life needs liquid water. And so any place with liquid water is a place that we consider a possible environment of life. We certainly don't have evidence of life on Europa, but because there may be an ocean there, it spurs our imagination to think that there might possibly have been some critters that evolved there. As far as we know on Earth, all it took for life to evolve was an ocean and an energy source. And there probably are energy sources on Europa.
So is NASA thinking about sending some kind of probe that's going to drill beneath the ice and go scuba diving, looking around for microbes or whatever it might find
under? Actually, there are a couple of proposals. There's one proposal to send basically a probe up that's like a bowling ball that you just smack into the surface and knock some chips off, and then you return some of those ice chips to Earth to analyze.
All right, we want to go underneath and see what's down below.
Well, that's another one. It would be more expensive, but you actually send something with a little energy generator that melts its way down through the ice.
Yeah, I say if we're going to go there, let's go all the way. Let's go all the way down to the bottom of the ocean.
That would be fun.
While we're talking about Jupiter here, I saw a thing on CNN last week. The probe finally went into the atmosphere of Jupiter, goes scooting down in beneath the clouds, and those colorful, they got orange and yellow and pretty clouds up there on Jupiter. And they sent back like a cartoon 3D image of what it looked like. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen that yet. They actually made a 3D image of the probe
data?
Yeah,
it's like that one that you might have seen of Mars and of Venus that if you watch PBS, you might see these things.
Yeah,
they got one like that now for Jupiter.
I've got the Mars and Venus ones on videotape, but I haven't seen the Jupiter one. I haven't been watching CNN recently because I was away riding horses in Wyoming last week. It sounds like I missed something.
Must be. Well, yeah. Check it out then,
the
dude.
World of astronomy doesn't wait for you, Dr. Grinspoon.
No, you're absolutely right. Clearly, I've been missing out. Good thing I'm talking to you guys.
Yeah, it looks like we actually got another caller here. Dallas, you're on with Dr. David Grinspoon from the University of Colorado.
All right, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. I heard that there's a new planet. Like, they haven't, like, a planet like X or whatever.
Yeah, they just discovered a new little ice ball out beyond Pluto. Whether or not you consider it a planet is getting to be kind of a question of definition. In fact, you know, you've probably heard that some people are questioning whether Pluto should be called a planet or not, and, you know, poor little Pluto may be getting demoted, but that's, you know, sort of getting into semantics, what you call a planet and what you don't. But the interesting thing is that we're starting to find these objects out beyond Pluto, and they just discovered this new one. It's basically just a big ice ball a few hundred miles across, and it seems like there are probably a lot of these sort of a little ice world.
Well, there's a comet belt out there somewhere, isn't there, called the Oort cloud?
Yeah, now that's further out. The Oort cloud is about hundreds of thousands of times the distance, or tens of thousands at least times the distance of Earth from the sun. Much, much, much farther out than Pluto. The interesting thing about these new objects that they're finding, and they just found this one last week that the caller mentioned, is that they're just outside the orbit of Pluto, so they're sort of an extension of the planetary region. And then, as you mentioned, there's this Oort cloud, which is much farther out at the outer fringes of the solar system, you know, like 40,000 times as far away from the sun as the Earth is, that's got all the comets in it.
Well, there you go, Dallas.
All right, thanks a lot.
Hey,
sure,
you bet.
Thank you.
F-town.
The doctor, you're on the air with Dr. Grinspoon.
What's going on, Chris and Rob?
Now, are you really a doctor?
Ask him if he's familiar with Dr. Love Johnson.
This is Dr. Love Johnson. Welcome to the Chris and Rob Show.
Hey,
what do you have to say to Dr. David Harry Grinspoon?
Well, I heard you guys talking earlier about Europa.
Yeah.
And it had to do with, like, the moon on Jupiter and stuff like that. Did you also read the story 2061?
Oh, the
Odyssey number
three story.
Yes.
You know, I haven't read that one. I probably should, but I keep finding, I mean, 2001 was such a mind-blowing experience, both the movie and the book, and again, one of these formative experiences, and I just found it so
2001, Ferris nipples.
Awe-provoking. And then 2010, I found, was like a little bit less kind of awesome. And then I'm sort of afraid to read 2061. I mean, maybe it would blow me away,
actually,
but
I almost
want the mystery to remain, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, 2061 to me was the best of the three books.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it recommend it. I guess I'll have to go out and get it.
That's right.
So what's your fascination with Venus? You had like 9 planets to choose from, and you chose Venus.
Yeah, what's
Why?
Wrong with Mercury or Saturn or Uranus?
Well, let's I'm not going to comment on that last one. Let's stick to Mercury and Saturn.
What's wrong with Uranus?
Mercury's a really boring place. I mean, I shouldn't say that because I have friends that are Mercury experts that might get upset. But again, it's one of these dead worlds.
Do you call them Mercury heads?
I do, yes. It's one of the Mercurians. It's one of these, you know, again, small dead worlds where nothing really much has happened.
I was a kid, I heard that Mercury always faced the same way to the sun, and on one side was the hottest place in the solar system, but the other side was the coldest place in the solar system.
We used to think that, but now it turns out that Mercury rotates slowly, so it doesn't have that always facing the sun.
Well, Venus doesn't rotate all that quickly either, does it?
No, Venus rotates slowly, but everywhere on Venus is the same temperature because the atmosphere is so thick that it kind of redistributes the heat. But the thing is, I got into Venus because because it's such an Earth-like place. It's the closest planet to Earth, and it's the most similar in a lot of ways. And something about the similarities to Earth really grabbed me, the fact that there's this other planet so nearby that has so many parallels to Earth. And then there was this weird business of it being shrouded in clouds and kind of the mystery of trying to figure out what's beneath those clouds that we finally been able to do with these recent spacecraft missions.
Well, tell us about the Magellan. That's the spacecraft that went up there, shot all these pictures. How did it shoot a picture underneath all those clouds from orbit?
Well, it used radar, basically. It was a really neat innovation. You can't do it with a normal camera. The light just bounces off the clouds. But we put the spacecraft in orbit, and it sends radio pulses that bounce off the surface of the planet. The radio waves go right through the clouds in the atmosphere, no problem. They bounce off the planet, and then they're received again on the spacecraft with an antenna. The signals are sent back to Earth, and we use those to construct an image. And
sort of like how a bat uses its radar to eat bugs?
It's similar, yeah. Bats actually use sound. They use sonar, but it's basically the same principle. You're bouncing some kind of a wave and then getting the return signal.
We probably don't have those pictures in color, though, do we?
No, they're not in color, but they're very striking. They're highly detailed pictures, and you know, we went from having almost no knowledge of the surface to now having images of the entire surface down to the detail where you can see something the size of a football field.
Well, give them
and
a Ted Turner.
We haven't seen any football fields, but we see lots of really cool stuff on the surface.
Yeah, have you thought about asking Ted Turner to colorize them for you?
Hey, have you ever dated a chick named Venus?
No, I never have done that, but. But actually, NASA has done some really ugly colorizations of the images. I think they actually look they look really beautiful in black and white. I'm a fan of black and white.
In your book, Venus Revealed, there's an inside little section there of pictures. They're all in black and white. When I first picked up the book and I saw all these pictures of the surface of Venus in black and white, I thought, man, what a jip. Why aren't these things in color? But as you read on...
They are in color.
They are in color. They're in Venus color.
Yeah, that's right. There's an insert of color images in the book, too. So there's
a black
and white section and a color section.
That's
but the new Magellan images are all in black and white.
The color section, though, the color section is not the pictures that Magellan shot.
Right, right. The Magellan pictures don't have color. If we want color images of the surface of Venus, which, by the way, I think we should, I would love to see what it really looks like in color, we're going to have to go below the clouds to take pictures.
When's that going to happen?
Well, whenever we get the will and the money together. See, I think it would be really neat to send some kind of a drone airplane that flies, either an airplane or a balloon that flies below the clouds with a telescopic camera and actually takes pictures in color of the surface. That's something we can do, and we decide that we want to, but we have no immediate plans to do that. It would take some bucks, basically.
Now, unfortunately, on the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show, the viewer at home, unless they've got a copy of your book, don't have access to these pictures. But these are really amazing looking pictures. Looks like you got big, giant mushrooms on the surface of Venus.
Yeah, there really is an amazing range of different kinds of features we see on the surface of the planet, some of which are shockingly familiar. They look just like, you know, there's some volcanoes and even things that look like riverbeds that look just like things we see on Earth.
One picture looks like Las Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. That was, you know, one of the unfortunate findings. But there's also features on the planet that we've just never seen on any planet before. So it's an interesting mix of the familiar and the bizarre.
We get people from NASA from time to time to call into the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. And whether we're discussing comets or planets or, you know, the Project SETI, ET radio signals or whatever, I always like to ask legitimate scientific type people with doctorates what they think of Richard Hoagland, some of his claims about the face on Mars, the structures on the moon, and all the NASA cover-ups that seem to ensue from that. Dr. Grinspoon, what do you think of Richard Hoagland and the face on Mars?
I think he's full of fecal matter.
You do?
Yeah. The
he gets a lot of press, though.
Yeah, I know he does, and he's making some bucks, too. The thing is, there are a lot of really mysterious things we found on the planet.
Is there anything on Venus?
There are mysterious features on Venus that we cannot explain. But the face on Mars is not mysterious. It's a rock formation, and when you look
at
pictures,
got this city next to it that's identical to the one by the pyramids and the Sphinx.
Yeah,
it's all the
same. Yeah. When you look at pictures taken in other lighting conditions, when the sun's at a different angle and the shadows are in other lighting conditions, then it's not all that face-like. I mean, it's vaguely face-like, but if you look all around the Earth at all the different geological formations, you can find, you know, a face and a bunny rabbit and a, you know, whatever. It's just a lot of hooey unfortunately, a lot of gullible people are spending, you know, money on books that are being promoted by people that really know better.
Well, they should be spending their money on books like Venus Revealed, A New
Exactly.
Look Below the Clouds of Our Mysterious Twin Planet by David Harry Grinspoon of University of Colorado.
You got it.
Hey, you want to talk to Tudge?
Sure.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Hello, Tudge, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What's on your mind there, Tudge, baby?
All right. I got a question.
All right, this is going to be good.
If aliens were going to invade Earth, how would they survive with our atmosphere if they're on planets that we discovered that are still, like,
Well, you know, Dr. Grinspoon, that might actually be a better question than we're giving him credit for on the outside. Because if we wanted to go to Venus and invade, we'd have some problems.
Oh, actually, I think it's a good question. I don't think that there's any problem with that question at all. And I think it's a good point. You know, in all these science fiction movies, they often gloss over that. You know, on Star Trek, everybody lands on everybody else's planet, and it's no problem. They can just walk around and breathe and have a good time. But the chances of there being another planet in the universe that is similar enough to Earth that we could just walk around and breathe and not be killed by the atmosphere is very small. And so by the same token, any aliens invading here would be at a distinct disadvantage because of our atmosphere.
That's why Mars Attacks was such a great movie, is because it was so realistic. All
I
the
love
Martians.
That movie. I really identified with the scientist guy with his pipe.
You're a Pierce Brosnan.
Like
yeah.
That movie ET, like when ET comes down, he like dies. You know, he gets all white, his neck gets all long. You know what I'm saying?
Right, but what's the point? Your
Elliot,
point being?
Elliot wasn't feeding him.
Oh, that was what the problem
was.
That
was the problem, I think.
Reese Pieces just don't cut it, do
they? Don't have E.T.
Yeah.
Chow there at aisle 8 of the Thriftway.
Hey, thanks for your call, Tudge.
All right, thanks a lot.
Later.
Hey, I got another question in a similar vein there, Dr. Grinspoon.
Yeah?
Who could win a fight between Superman and the Hulk?
Oh, I think probably the Superman would win, because
where'd
Superman is, like, you know, really has these major supernatural powers, whereas the Hulk is just this, like, big, strong guy. But I don't think he'd stand a chance. But that's just my you know, first impression. I haven't really studied the question.
All right. It's getting late here. We're probably keeping you from something better to do. The book is called Venus Revealed. It's available
I gotta go watch Star Trek.
Do what?
I got to go watch Star Trek.
Are you into that really, or are you being funny?
No, I am really into it.
You science dudes, man. You guys are on the internet, and you watch Star Trek, and you analyze all the science in these TV shows to see if they're accurate.
Yeah, and mostly they're not. They're good with the jargon. They're good at throwing the jargon around.
Oh, the jargon's great. Hey, we got another call for you.
All right.
Let us know when we got to quit. Hello, Matt. You're on the air.
Yeah, man. How you guys doing?
Fabulous.
Yeah, I want to know if they have any life forms like donkeys or lizards or anything on Venus.
Well, we haven't discovered any donkeys or lizards, anything concrete like that on Venus. And, I suspect if there is life there, it would be more like something that unrecognizable to us that we don't have a name for. But there certainly are a lot of mysterious features on the planet that we haven't been able to explain yet. So whenever you've got a planet with large-scale, mysterious, global features, there's always a possibility that you're seeing signs of life. You know, there's some strange things in the atmosphere and on the surface that we can't explain. But no donkeys or lizards or dinosaurs or 50-foot women yet.
What about lungfish?
No lungfish. A good question, though.
Okay, thanks for your time tonight, David.
Sure, thanks a lot.
Venus revealed a new look below the clouds of our most mysterious twin planet. Thanks for your time, David.
Sure, thanks a lot.
This is the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. Stay tuned. More is yet to come, isn't it?